TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I've got to say, I have had it with this Cardassian architecture. I just stubbed my toe again this morning trying to walk through a door. Why do they have to make it so hard to get around?
Just completely inconsiderate jerk faces, Chris. I don't understand it either. Why in the world should I have to step over something every time I want to enter a new room? It makes zero sense. Maybe they just are truly insensitive jerks. That's really what it is, Chris. They're just insensitive jerks.
I have a theory. I think those Cardassian voles that infiltrated the station, I think that they're really bad at jumping, and that these little obstacles in the doorways just prevent them from going to room because they just can't get over them.
See, that makes sense. That would make that it's like a vole trap, really. that's what all of Deep Space Nine actually is. It's just a large vole trap. It's good to know that the inconvenience to bipedal species is because of a vermin infestation.
Yeah. It's critter control. I call them volsticles.
How long were you thinking of that one, Chris? All morning?
Actually, no. It just came to me right now, which maybe says something about how my brain works. But anyway, everyone, we are going to continue our Deep Space Nine 30th anniversary rewatch today with episode 6 of season 2. It's Melora. And here is a quick rundown. Dr. Bashir and Chief O'Brien prepare for the arrival of a new cartographer, Ensign Melora Paslar. She is the first Elasian to join Starfleet. Why? Because her homeworld has low gravity, which makes it difficult for her people to function in environments common to Starfleet operations. She generally must use a wheelchair to move around, and Bashir has modified a special wheelchair for her to use while aboard Deep Space Nine. When he and Melora start to fall for one another, Bashir begins searching for a treatment that could allow her to walk. But there's a catch. She would never be able to return to her homeworld for more than a short visit. Meanwhile, some other stuff is happening with Quark. So that's the basic story, Matthew. And
Chris, are you saying that Melora is defying gravity?
She is. Yeah. I'm not sure if we're allowed to say that. They might take down the podcast for copyright violation just by referencing the name of a popular song.
Of
like
Wicked.
That.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I'm so sorry. Well, we know we're going to be driving an incredible amount of traffic now to the Wicked soundtrack because we've referenced their song. So you're welcome, Wicked. There's tens and tens of more dollars for you.
That's right. You're wicked welcome. All right. So this story is kind of an interesting one because the story itself, it's always stuck in my mind because of having the character who is in a wheelchair. But it turns out that this character, maybe not specifically Melora played by this actress, but the having an officer who is confined to a wheelchair unless they're in their quarters or in another special environment on the station, was part of the original concept of the series. They wanted to have this character as part of the crew, but they decided not to do it in part because of budgetary restrictions. It would have been, especially at this point in 1993, extremely expensive to have a character like this on a science fiction show where you've always going to have to show the special environment that she's in. You think about the flying scenes in here and what was involved in that. And so they decided not to do that, but it was always on the back burner. And so when the writer of this story, Evan Carlos Summers, was looking at more possibilities of stories to pitch to Deep Space Nine, he also did Battle Lines, and then he did Meridian, which is coming up. Oh, and he did also, Matthew, one that we recently talked about on To the Journey, Ex Post Facto. So he writes a certain type of story when you look at the love story angle, I suppose. But he himself was a paraplegic and was using a wheelchair. And so this idea was appealing to him, and he wanted to try to tell the story in a positive way from the perspective of someone who's dealing with these issues. So that's sort of the source of the character and the idea of the story. So as a starting point, what do you think about if they had kept the character, the crew member who's in a wheelchair, and how would that have played out week to week from a storytelling point of view? Would it have been practical?
I think that is fascinating, the idea that might try to make that work. And, you know, I think that it's interesting. Even today, that's not something that you see very often. Mm-hmm. And I do think that it could be possibly because of the cost involved. And, you know, that's not an excuse as to why that shouldn't happen. But I think specifically on a Star Trek show, you do think of the tight quarters that you're in, you know, the sets that you're in, and trying to make that work. And of course, you know, if you had had that, you know, the design of the Cardassian station might itself even have been different. Mm-hmm. Because of the need for ease of use for this person. And so I think on that side, it is an interesting idea. What I find most interesting about the idea of Melora as a character is that she is not actually somebody who is in any way disabled.
Right. That's a key point.
She is only this way because of the way her species has developed. Mm-hmm. In a lower gravity environment compared, yeah, to the one that most bipedal species we see in Star Trek live on. Right. And so, you know, I mean, we know that Vulcans live on a slightly higher gravity planet than, say, even Earth. It's one, mm-hmm, of the ways in which they are stronger than humans and those kind of things. So from that standpoint, I think it's actually a fascinating idea, right, that, mm-hmm, that there would be members of the Federation that might have these differences, which would create problems when we all try to get together. And the fact that Melora is, I think they even say, the first Elasian, mm-hmm, who has, yeah, decided to be in Starfleet because of these issues. So, and that, I think that's really fascinating. And that's what makes the story, I think, so much more interesting, because the mindset of coming from a place, you know, where who you are is completely, quote unquote, normal. But then, mm-hmm, you put yourself in a different context and you're what would be considered abnormal or different or, you know, any of those type of things. You know, there's so many different types of words that we might use to describe that. And that makes for, then, I think, kind of a very interesting character study then with the character of Melora and, you know, then her interactions with other people. And it creates a much more interesting character that allows them to kind of write the conflicts that come in with that character, mm-hmm, in conjunction with all of our Deep Space Nine regulars.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think going to the point of the disability, and does she truly have a disability? Yeah, it is only because of the environment that she has to work in as part of Starfleet. And we've seen this with other species in Star Trek, like benzites. Benzites cannot breathe the standard atmosphere
that you
have on a starship, right? So they have this little breathing apparatus. But because that need is limited only to having this little thing under their face that allows them to breathe the atmosphere that they need to breathe, other crew members don't look at them like, oh, they're disabled. It's just like, oh, well, you need that to breathe. But in the case of Malara, because she has to use the wheelchair, then the perception changes a lot. But in reality, it's really the same situation, right? Benzites can't breathe the atmosphere. Elasians come from a planet with low gravity, so they can't stand under the normal gravity on a starship.
Well, and I do think, I mean, one of the interesting things about this is the defensiveness that we get from Malara as a character, as mm-hmm. she is preemptively being defensive against mm-hmm. other people and kind of pushing them away mm-hmm. because of her experience of her thinking, you know, everybody thinking she needs more help. But in reality, I mean, there are things in which she can't do on her own, the same mm-hmm. way there are things in which I can't do on my own, you can't do on your own, mm-hmm. and even people, you know, Julian even tells her, you know, we all need each other in space. We're all having to rely on each other. Nobody is an island unto themselves. You know, that's mm-hmm. just not the way we're created. We're created as relational beings, you know. You put somebody in solitary confinement, they're not going to do well. And so there's a whole sense in which we need each other even in that way. So that mm-hmm. was also, I think, a really interesting conversation then, because she wants to be able to prove that she can do everything that mm-hmm. anybody else can do. And yet I can't do everything that you can do. You mm-hmm. can't do everything that I can do. And we're pretty similar, right, as people. But mm-hmm. There are all of these limitations that we all have in our lives, and it's in recognizing those limitations and being then big enough as a person to then ask for help mm-hmm. and being okay with relying on another person is really the core concept almost of Star Trek, right? Infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And so that idea really is that we are better off with one another together than we are separately.
Yeah, right, right. Well, looking at the issue in this episode of being disabled and being defensive, it's an interesting one to be, because when I watch the episode, I'm sort of put off to the character of Malara from the start because she comes in so defensive. And you've seen the setup where Bashir is so excited that she's going to come to the station, and he and O'Brien have been working on getting everything ready for her. And she's greeted, I feel, by Sisko and Dax and everyone as another Starfleet officer. And she has some different needs that they don't have because they didn't grow up on a low gravity planet. But otherwise, they're there to help her, but she is accusing them of looking at her as needing special treatment from the beginning. And even Sisko says, I don't see anybody doing that. And I think that part of the reason that it comes across that way, despite the fact, as I mentioned up front, that the writer Sommers was in a wheelchair himself and had the experience, which he has talked about in magazine interviews, of being there in the building working on Star Trek and having to get around in the wheelchair and facing some of the obstacles of being able to move around in the building. So he wanted to tell a story from the perspective of someone who's in that situation. But his original story didn't go over so well with the writing team. And it was ultimately rewritten many times, I think 4 or 5 times. And I feel like what happened in the end is that the viewpoint got flipped around so that the story is being told instead of from Malara's perspective or Sommers' perspective as the writer. It's instead being told from the perspective of Piller and the other writers who worked on the script, who are like you and me, where we're not in the wheelchair. And so we don't have firsthand understanding of what the situation is like. And so some of the dialogue, some of the attitude from both sides, but I feel when I watch it a lot from Melora, seems to have shifted from the original intention because the people who were ultimately writing it don't have the firsthand experience to be able to tell things through her eyes.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that way for sure. You know, I it's interesting because I really do think that the key discussion in the episode is really when Bashir does kind of challenge her to say, hey, what you're doing is keeping yourself isolated on purpose. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something really interesting about that because we as a society, I think a lot of people have kind of become more like this, which is I keep everybody at arm's length because I don't want to get hurt. And the only experience I have in any sense of community is the one that I control and I can literally just turn off anytime, whether mm-hmm. it's online or any of those type of things, right? And so I found this to be an interesting thing because regardless of Melora's need for the wheelchair and any of these things in this environment, what she was doing is something that we as human beings tend to do a lot, regardless of whether we're in that type of situation or not. And I think the beauty of this is that the way I find the episode to be written and as I'm watching it, I don't have to be somebody who's in a wheelchair to understand what Melora is doing and why she's doing it. Mm-hmm. That's the thing I find really interesting about this episode. If anybody's honest, there's probably many points of their life where they have maybe acted like this so that they can protect themselves from ever getting hurt, you know? And so for her, there's the issue of losing face, getting hurt physically, and then protecting herself emotionally and basically just creating almost like a rock hard heart that can't be touched because you won't let anybody touch it, right? And so to me, I mean, it's like a lot of those things don't even have anything to do with necessarily being in a wheelchair for her. And so that's the thing I was really struck by watching this episode again, because I think this is much more common mm-hmm. as a behavior than maybe it was back when this was written by people who don't have these type of issues.
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah.
And so I find that to be really interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, as for whether or not it's not written enough from her perspective, I don't know. I don't know if I agree or disagree. But I would have been interested to kind of know what the baseline story was from his perspective from the beginning and like mm-hmm. what his script read like. That I think that would be really interesting to know.
What I know about the original script is that the overall story was not a great story, and there was stuff in there involving other characters and other situations, even part of the B story, that I think wouldn't have made a great Star Trek episode. So I can understand why they felt like that one wouldn't work and they needed to work on it. I think that maybe the rewriting process could have kept him more involved in terms of the elements that are tied directly to her situation being in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
And also you mentioned that in today's world, compared to when this was written, you see this type of defensive attitude in a lot of areas where people aren't dealing with a physical disability or challenge like this, but it could be other things, even just issues that they care about, where people become extremely defensive and shut everybody out because they don't want to hear any perspective that's not the same as theirs. And maybe that's to protect themselves. But you do see that more often. And that's something that struck me also when I was watching it. I wanted to mention, though, at the beginning of the episode, when Dr. Bashir describes her, he says that she went through the academy the same way. Once her basic needs are met, she refuses any special assistance. She's extraordinary. And the way he describes it, and the way he glows when he talks about it, I think set me up to expect a different character coming in. And that's something where I feel like maybe that take on her comes from an earlier version of the story, whereas the portrayal, based on what Daphne Ashbrook, the actress, was given to, you know, her lines, it just doesn't jive for me with how she was set up. And then she talks about the problem, and she says that she tells Dax and Sisko that, "I'm sorry if I'm overly sensitive. I'm used to being shut out of the Melora problem." And then she says, "The truth is, there is no Melora problem until people create one." And in that scene itself, my feeling hearing the lines was that she's creating the Melora problem herself. It's not being created by Sisko or Dax or Bashir or O'Brien or anyone else on the station, because they have not done anything yet. All they've done is try to help her. But with the way that she comes in, she's creating that wall automatically. And so she's, you know, and then I picture that in her other interactions in Starfleet, she's doing the same thing. And so she's actually creating the very problem that she's saying is being used to shut her out of things.
Right. And I think that's actually a really astute part of this episode, right? Which is that we can unintentionally be the people who cause friction because of this type of behavior. And again, we don't have to even be people that might be in a wheelchair or something like that, because like you said, she, her saying the whole idea of the Melora problem, well, yeah, the Melora problem is actually not just accepting your own limitations. And again, this is not, this doesn't really even need to be about whether or not somebody's in a wheelchair or whether or not somebody can't do math, which I don't do math. I'm terrible at math. And so I think that's the thing, is that, you know, there's this, there is kind of this perspective almost that she has, which is, I should be able to do literally anything else that anybody else should do. It's like she's kind of bought into that kind of psychobabble of today. You can be whatever you want to be. Well, actually, you can't, because we all have natural limitations in and of ourselves that don't make it possible for us to do whatever we want to do. I'm never going to be an NBA star. I'm never going to be an NFL star. I'm never even going to be an MLB star. You know, so, I mean, there are things that I'm not going to do because I don't have a certain amount of gifting in a certain area. And we all have to make peace with that and be okay with other choices that then, you know, come before us. And you know, I think Sisko is right in even saying in the end, yeah, I would never let an ensign who just got here go on a mission by themselves to the Gamma Quadrant, a quadrant we legitimately know so little about.
He didn't even let Kira go by herself.
Exactly. And so I think what's beautiful about this episode is that it really does do a great job of helping us kind of be able to look at this character from a perspective of being able to see ourselves in her in all the different ways in which I might do the exact same type of thing, but for different reasons. And that's what's really great about the episode in that sense. And that's where I think they actually did a pretty great job, because, and I appreciate that this isn't an episode like where we bring in a type of character and then they could do no wrong and they have nothing to learn. I think that also sets up a false dichotomy. And Deep Space Nine is, again, as we've mentioned before, is much more nuanced than that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the beauties, I think, that makes this show really work. And it's what makes it continue to succeed year in and year out all these years later.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I think the episode does really well is that it takes her on a journey, and she opens up to Bashir, and then she's presented with this possibility of not needing the chair anymore, mm-hmm. because she talks about how she's been in a chair ever since she left her planet, some kind of chair. So she has this desire. She thinks that if she could get out of the chair, she could achieve even more, all these goals that she has for herself. And she's presented with this opportunity. First of all, she's allowed to be herself with Bashir, turning off the gravity in her quarters, and she relaxes a lot. She really opens up. And they also show when she realizes what's happening and she pulls back. So when they're sitting in the restaurant and, you know, she's smiling, and then suddenly she realizes that Bashir is gazing at her because they're really hitting it off. And she becomes very defensive again, just on her face. Like, you know, she closes up. And so she's going on this journey. And then by the end, she comes to understand that she's better off being who she is. She doesn't need to shed the chair. You know, she, it might not be the most convenient. So I do think the episode does a good job, even if I don't think that it addresses all the issues as well as it could. I think from a character standpoint, it does a good job of talking about how we face limitations that we have and come to terms with those.
Yeah.
And learn to use them as a strength for who we are.
Right. Well, in the end, like you said, I mean, the beauty of the relationship that she ends up having with Bashir is that she thinks that she wants one thing, which is complete independence, right? And in the end, what she learns is that because of Bashir, because of him kind of being willing to lovingly, I think, kind of crack a cold one here, you know, is to help her see it's okay for me to be dependent on other people. It's okay for me to need other people. And it's okay for me to be who I am as an Elasian and not give that up, because I think my life would be better or easier. And it would make me need people less. You know, I find that to be such a beautiful message, because she doesn't need to give up who she is. And in fact, one of the things I think I wanted to ask you about this, the episode almost makes it seem as though, oh, she's going to be an Elasian and she's going to continue to need the low gravity environment. Does that preclude her from being in a relationship with somebody like Bashir? I mean, why would that preclude them from being able to be together, you know, and mean an end to this romance, you know?
Well, I don't think it would if they were going to be both on the station, right? I think what precludes a romance is what she and Jadzia talk about on the runabout, the subspace relationship. Yeah. Right, where you
I think that
you're physically apart, but
exactly.
But if they're together in the same place, of course, there's no reason why it would get in the way of them having a relationship. I mean, what's the only thing is that they would spend some time together in low gravity, right? Which
I guess that gives whole new meaning to the Mile High Club.
It does, yeah. Or at least the meter high club.
The meter high club,
in the case of the quarters.
Yes, exactly.
And the ceiling height in there. But yeah, I mean, and it was a new experience for Bashir the first time, which we see in the episode, but it's something that he would quickly grow accustomed to, right? So yeah, it's not really an obstacle at all. I think, you know, in our own world, we all have some kind of problem. Many of us have physical problems that require adaptation in situations like that, and we all still manage to be in relationships and friendships and do things together. And so, yeah, I don't see that as an obstacle, no.
Well, I mean, kind of speaking about Bashir, then what do you think of, you know, just how, you know, he comes off in the episode, the fact that, you know, there's the moment where he's like, oh, I'm not your doctor anymore, but then he's kind of her doctor for the rest of the
right.
episode. Yeah. So that whole situation, I wondered how you felt about that.
Well, at first when he said, I'm not your doctor anymore, because I haven't watched this episode in years, I stopped for a minute to think, okay, wait, did he resign from being her doctor and pass her over to another doctor because she was so abrasive when she came aboard and she didn't like the fancy chair that he made for her? Right? But then I thought, well, no, it's not that. He's just saying, talk to me as a normal person. Don't talk to me as your doctor for a moment. Right. No, I thought Bashir comes off really well in this episode because, yes, it is a romance. And he does have this image going back to the beginning of the series of looking for the ladies, but it doesn't feel like that here. I mean, at the beginning, it's a little bit weird that he's so enamored with her just from reading her case history and learning about her. And I guess the implication is they've been talking over subspace, I guess, to figure out what she needs and he can work on the chair and all.
Yeah.
But there's nothing wrong with that. You know, maybe he really hit it off with her as they were talking. But I think the important thing here is that he doesn't at all come across as someone who's trying to get close to this woman because she's new to the station and she's come aboard and he sees an opportunity. He seems like genuinely interested in her. Her situation presents him with a challenging medical and scientific problem, which is something that's very appealing to him. But as she starts to open up to him and he starts to learn more about her background and why she's defensive and so forth, it feels like they have a natural chemistry. I think that Siddig and Ashbrook as actors had real chemistry together as well. I think it comes through in their scenes together. And I think that also helps to make this love story for Bashir work and feel like a natural and a good evolution of the character as we've seen him become a lot more mature over the course of the second season.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I get from this, and part of this comes from, you know, us being in a 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine, which is, I think that the beauty in watching this in retrospective is that Bashir is enamored with her because she has had to go through the academy and fight not to be seen as being different.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Bashir would have had to do the same thing because he's genetically enhanced and therefore he would have been working to not be seen as different by anybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something that is very attractive to him about that as he meets Melora and is really attracted to her strength, her desire to overcome any obstacle that's been placed in front of her. And I think there's something really awesome about that for him. And I think that's something that so many of us find in people in general, right? That you, those people that we meet in their lives, there's something about them that allows them to be seen in a different light. And when we do see them in that light, we're just like, wow, this is, there's just something like kind of like, whoa, about that person. You know, you just literally have a kind of a different type of reaction about them.
Yeah.
And so I think, yeah, that's the thing that makes this really interesting. And I agree with you. I think, honestly, Bashir does, I think, come off very reserved in this episode. He never seems to really be pushing her in any direction. It is clear on his face that there is a direction he would like her to go. But as a good physician. He gives her all the options. He leaves mm-hmm. everything up to her. He tells her exactly what she needs to know to win this would be something that's irreversible. And he completely leaves the decision in her lap. And I think he is brutally honest with her too, right? And saying, hey, if you do this, this will be the byproduct of that. This mm-hmm. is going to be the consequence of that. Mm-hmm. So you need to be prepared for that, because if you do to go too far down this road, you can't change. And mm-hmm. so I think there's something really great there for him and the character of Bashir, where I think in this episode, we actually see quite a bit of growth in mm-hmm. the character of Bashir and who he is. And I think it's actually a good episode for him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And the fact that they show all of those possibilities, and then she's having second thoughts, and then he's explaining what could happen, and they talk about at what point is it irreversible and such, is also important for her character, the journey that I mentioned, because they don't give us like a very simple path for her. They show us how she's really having to consider the possibilities along the way. So I'm glad that they put that in there as well. Let's talk a little bit about the B story, because I have to say, and until you get to the end, I think you're really left feeling like, why is this B story in this episode in the first place? Because there's a lot more that they could do with the character of Melora, and they could do with Bashir and Melora, and even talking about the issues surrounding perceived disabilities, I'm going to call them, because like we said up front, she's not actually disabled. It's only when she's in this environment that she faces these challenges. But there's a lot they could have done with all of this, and we've got this very generic Quark story going on that it almost feels like there's some kind of little book or dispenser on the desk. Like, okay, we need a Quark story. You know, it's like you mix and match things he might've gotten into, someone he might be mixed up with.
Was this written by the manatee thought ball process that yeah. South Park said that Family Guy wrote its episodes by? Yeah.
It feels like it at times. And, you know, even the antagonist for Quark here, like the portrayal is just not even threatening. It's just so generic. And then you get to the end and you realize, oh, they needed to find a way. And Michael Piller even said this. He said about the B story, it was always there because we needed to put these people in jeopardy. But the B story was a struggle. We never quite knew what it was going to be. And I would say that is a very accurate assessment of what we get. They figured out what it was going to be, but it doesn't actually feel like much of a story until you realize at the end that they needed to find a way to put Melora in the situation where she was in danger, and also a situation where she could use her abilities to her advantage to save everyone. And by doing so, she could come to the realization that she's strong as the person that she is, and she doesn't need to give up the chair, and she doesn't need to do the treatments. She can be who she is, and that's okay. And so the B story works to get you there, but it just feels like a really long path to get to that final moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, I can't disagree with that. I think there really is a lot of truth to what you're saying. I think one of the most interesting things about this B story is that the one thing that it allows us to do here for Quark is remind us that Quark is not a great guy. It allows us to kind of be able to see, his shady side and just how shady it is, you know, and just kind of what a morally, kind of reprehensible and ambiguous person that he is, that he would be willing to sell somebody out, you know, and so of course he doesn't have to go to prison as well. And basically you get that feeling like, oh, he's responsible for getting somebody kind of into this mess, as they were partners, and not responsible in the sense like he's the only one responsible, but like he's a big part of this. And you know, he's not going to take any responsibility for that. If there's a way for him to get out of it. So, you know, I find that to be very interesting. And so I kind of love that part of the story for Quark. And I think that's the part of the story that's kind of well done and really works. Everything else, though, that you said is right on target, right? Like this, you absolutely nailed the fact that this does feel like a story that could legitimately happen on any single season of Deep Space Nine, really. It is the most generic kind of Quark story. Oh, Quark's not a great guy, so he has somebody come back that, you know, wants to kill him, and then that will... We'll find a way to coincide that with our A story and, you know, yeah, it's not great. I mean, the best part about the story is that, you know, Odo is able to say, unfortunately, you know,
no, the best part.
He's going to do his job, unfortunately. And so it's just fantastic. That part's fantastic. And it's kind of a great moment for their relationship. Mm-hmm. So there's some okay things about it, but like you said, in the end, it's not like it's memorable, really. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it almost feels like it would have just been better to not have this B story at all and just have the whole thing be the A story and have kind of in some ways, you know, say Sisko to be proven right in the sense that, no, I'm not going to just send an ensign there out by herself, mm-hmm. you know, so that her and Dax might have to work together because the runabout's been hijacked or something. Kind of thing. You know, again, you could have totally rewritten this episode with it and not had to use Quark at all.
Right. That's the thing, that there are many ways that you could have put Melora and other crew members in danger at the end where Melora turned off the gravity and saved everybody. There are all sorts of possibilities. The fact that it happened the way it did, it's okay. It's just that it feels like they spent half of their time working their way towards that with a really generic Quark story. But about Odo, the part you said is not the best part for Odo and Quark in their relationship. The best part is when Quark asks, what if the final moment is it? And Odo says,
oh my
your
gosh,
people
so
sell
good.
Pieces of yourselves when you die, right? Yes.
Yes.
I'll buy one.
Yes.
I love that.
So good.
It's so just good. Dismissive of Quark's concerns and just an insult at the same time. But it also shows their relationship. Like, we know that, like, they need each other, right? Those two characters ultimately need each other, but they'll never admit it to each other.
Yeah, so fantastic.
I love that. Yeah. All right. Well, any final thoughts, and what are you going to give this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a good episode, and I do think that, you know, one of the reasons that it's kind of, like you mentioned, not a great episode is the discussion that we had there about the Quark B story. But all in all, I think I'd give this 3.75 grav units out of 5, because I think that there's a lot to really like about this episode, especially when it comes to the storyline that we get for Bashir and, you know, his growth as a character, and then of course Melora. So I really enjoy this episode. It's not one where, you know, you're doing your rewatch, you're like, I can skip that one. No, I think this is definitely one that's worthwhile watching. It's because it gives us a lot of great character growth for Bashir.
With your rating there, I assume that Starfleet does the same thing that computer companies do today when they make microchips. And for example, system on a chip, one of the GPUs doesn't work, so they bend the chip and then they put that in a lower priced product. A quarter of one of those grav units just doesn't work. This 3.75, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that's Starfleet tech as well. One thing I wanted to mention about this episode, there's this one exchange. When Sommers talked about his original idea for the story, he mentions multiple times about how he really wanted Bashir and Melora to have sex while they're flying in the air. How cool is that? And we don't really get to see that. We just get to see the kiss. But later on, when Melora is in the infirmary for treatments, she says, "My heart is pounding." And Bashir says, "I'd like to think that has more to do with me than the neo-analeptic infusion." And then Melora says, "Would that also explain why my backside is getting warm?" So what happened after the cameras cut away from that scene?
Do we want to know? That's the bigger question, actually, Chris.
Yeah, but our discussion was good. I think that good for me. I think that it helps me in how I think about the episode a little bit more. My thoughts on the whole defensive aspect of it are pretty nuanced because I think that people can put up walls when they don't have to because they probably come to feel like they're creating problems for other people when other people don't see it that way. And so they throw up these walls. And I get that feeling a lot when I see it. And I think that, like I said, some of the original intention of Sommers when he conceived of the first version of the story gets lost in all the rewrites. And I think that it's an important issue to address through science fiction and Star Trek. And but I think it's a delicate one that requires a lot of nuance to really talk about without being stereotypical about it. And I don't think the episode does it as effectively as it could. But it's also nice to see that, you know, even in 1993, they're thinking about issues such as accessibility and the station. You know, they put ramps so that she can move around. And, you know, I live in a country where, here in Japan, where accessibility, these days they're making a lot more effort, although not as much as they need to. But if you go to anything that was built 20, 30, 40 years ago or more, it's just a complete afterthought. You go in train stations where there's no escalator, there's no elevator, and then they'll put in an elevator, but it's on the complete other side of the platform. So anyone that needs to use it has to travel so far to get to it, or they'll have escalators going only one direction, not the other. A lot of issues.
Yeah. You know, we didn't even mention, but I think that's one of the ways in which this episode does show us a little bit of Cardassians, right? Which is that they wouldn't care about those people. They would not have any...
Because they would see them as weak and they shouldn't be there, right?
Which is great for us to kind of get that as a picture of who they are as a species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So in the end, anyway, I'm going to give this one 42 rings of Paltrus.
Oh, I thought you were going to give it Serenading Klingons, but...
I did think about that, yeah. Yeah, but I didn't have time to practice my Klingon pronunciation for those ratings. So
totally understandable.
Yeah. And also, I love that they slipped in 42 here from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So
yes.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Melora. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to join the Babel Conference on Facebook. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You will see a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me right there. You can also send us email, go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the orb, and that'll come to us. And you can also find us on social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we would love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not sending food back in a Klingon restaurant, where can people find you?
Well, you know, I just half dead. Gah, it's just, ugh, come on, guys, get it right.
I can't tell if you're expressing disgust over the food or ordering dishes. Gah, give me some gah.
You can find me all over social media under the name at Rushing02. Of course, also here on the network in the 602 Club as we talk about all of those franchises outside of Star Trek that we love. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One is called Outpost, about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, where we are now over 400 episodes in. So check that out. But Chris, you know, when you're not trying to just figure out exactly what kind of mood lighting you need to be half gravity, where can people find you?
I need to make sure I've got some good lighting up on the ceiling. That's all I can say. Yeah, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all the shows with you, of course. You can find me in many shows in the back catalog and also in social media. You can find me everywhere. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. And if you would like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support us, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support. So thank you so much to everyone who is supporting us now. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time when we're going to learn the rules of acquisition.
Well, Chris, that sounds great. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.